Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Media Answers Network, and is sponsored by the law offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Tom Leary, Senior Vice President of Government Relations at HIMSS. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me today.
It's great to have you on. And what I always like to do before really getting into the main part of the conversation is to let each of my guests provide a little bit more of a self-introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So the floor is yours.
Oh, perfect. I'm Tom Leary, Senior Vice President of Government Relations for HIMSS and Executive Director of our HIMSS Foundation. I've been with the organization just about 17 years and seen us grow into the real active government relations and advocacy group that we are now. I started in healthcare back in Pentagon and made my way into the nonprofit world through an opportunity with HIMSS, and here we are.
So what was healthcare work at the Pentagon like?
I was the legislative guy for the Pentagon, for the healthcare team as we were rolling out TRICARE. Actually, it was back in the early days of TRICARE. And we dealt with everything from Gulf War illnesses, people coming back from the first Gulf War with unexplained illnesses and research issues there, and then truly rolling out a managed care program, with the TRICARE program. It was eyes wide open, everything from anthrax vaccinations to, do you have a proper WIC program set up?
Yeah, that must have been pretty fascinating because I feel like you hear about all the challenges of rolling out major initiatives now with all of the different technology and communications platforms. And if you're talking 30 or so years ago now, you're at the nascent stage of, I think, a lot of that technology. So I feel like a lot of people can't even imagine what it would have been like.
Now, it was a lot of community. Each base had at least one place for active duty and family members to go and ask questions, and lots of community outreach, a lot of meetings around. And they're smart. They rolled it out on the West Coast and made their way to the East Coast and got things. As you're closer to population centers, you've made tweaks to the program to make it better. So yeah, it was a great education for me.
It sounds like kind of almost grassroots organizing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And, the Defense Health Agency now is a $50 billion organization. We're, at the time, it was about $15 billion a year for all of military health care, and just learning how to properly create a managed care program with partners from the, the private insurance to cover what couldn't be covered in the military treatment facilities. Yeah.
And what I want to do is kind of maybe make a pivot back to part of what you said, which is, you were saying that you were focused on legislative work there, and now you're doing government relations with HIMSS. So kind of what does government relations and that legislative kind of component cover? And I would say generally, and then also with an eye towards, obviously this is an election year, kind of how does that end up influencing what you do?
Absolutely. So from the government relations perspective, we really do interact with all levels of government here in the United States to advance the cause of our vision from HIMSS is better health for every human everywhere. And so we work with policymakers on educating them based on our members' practical experience for what current law or current regulations or how it impacts them, as well as begin to talk about the art of the possible, how to truly transform healthcare leveraging information and technology. So we with respect to our interaction with the current administration, or even the two candidates, Trump campaign and the Biden campaign. It's really providing that level of education and in reaction to their policy proposals. And once an administration is in place, it's working with them on on making sure that the regulations that are rolled out are can actually be delivered. Because one thing I've learned about HIMSS members over the years is that, and I'm sure we'll talk more about it with, you know, with this whole issue around the Affordable Care Act, is they figured out a way to make sure that health IT supports whatever the whatever changes to healthcare are brought to, you know, brought into the fore. So it's really an exciting place to be, you know, because our membership is just so enthusiastic about making sure that they do deliver on the better care, better health for every human everywhere.
Yeah, and you kind of just mentioned one of the big elephants in the room, which is what has all of a sudden become an extremely uncertain future for the Affordable Care Act. You know, so kind of what are you hearing in that regard? And maybe also just for everyone's benefit, tee up why there is so much concern at the moment.
Absolutely. You know, earlier this year, the Supreme Court made the announcement that they would be hearing a challenge, the latest challenge to the Affordable Care Act, 9 days after the election. That was all expected to go, you know, as one might expect it to go, interesting arguments, et cetera. Of course, with the with the death of, you know, of the American patriot, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it kind of changes the politics of it, gets involved. And, you know, what we're expecting is, you know, that what we understand is there will be an attempt by the Trump administration and the Senate's the Republicans in the Senate to have a nominee in place, and, you know, confirmed and in place, so that you have a full, you know, all nine justices available to hear the case on November 9th. What I've learned is that only the justices who have heard, who've been seated for the hearing of the case, can make a judgment on the case. So if, as it currently stands, it's you know, there's a potential for a 4-4 tie. That's why you would need that ninth judge in place. That's why the Senate Republicans really want that in place by the time that the hearing occurs in the second week of November, just after the election.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a good point, because, you know, even if you aren't able to get to that outcome of, you know, having a ninth justice there, if there was an even split, then the lower court's decision gets upheld, but it's not national precedent, which probably leaves us in extremely unknown waters, given that the district court said the whole law is invalid.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm not a lawyer, so you know what that all means for our membership and what for the healthcare community is. I think what it really lends itself to is that 2021 will be a year of healthcare change. You know, whether it's adjudicating changes to the Affordable Care Act or really just learning from what's, you know, the big elephant in the room, that, you know, the potential changes, long-term changes to healthcare delivery in the United States that's tied to the pandemic. We've done a lot of learning over the last 6 months in terms of how care can be delivered, telehealth, you know, improving access to care, addressing some of the issues around patient identification, public health infrastructure improvements, et cetera. That's all really lends itself to some great need for further improvements in healthcare law in the new year 2021-2022 timeframe.
Yeah, and to that point, so that you were just
irrespective of,
to that point that you were just raising, in terms of, you know, kind of regardless of what happens with the Affordable Care Act, as you were just mentioning, given all the changes that have been able to be enacted just because of the public health emergency, you know, how do you see, or kind of what are you hearing in terms of, you know, what's actually pending beyond regulations? Because, you know, I think we've seen some changes through some of the fee schedules, but recognition that, you know, legislation is likely necessary on top of that. So, you know, kind of how could that legislation be influenced by the ACA case, or kind of how is that evolving already?
You know, what each of the candidates are really looking at for at the as a presidential candidate level, you know, is what does care delivery look like, and how do you cover the most number of individuals as possible? I think another issue that really we have to address is that since COVID-19 began in the late winter, the upwards of 20 million Americans have lost their coverage that they had gained with the Affordable Care Act. So what is the next phase look like in terms of covering those individuals, or what changes, even if the Affordable Care Act is upheld, how do you shift the economy or change legislative requirements in order to make sure that we maximize the number of individuals that are covered? Because as we've seen over time, more individuals with insurance coverage means that there's more control of cost, and that you're not paying the higher prices of people just walking through the door in the emergency room like before the Affordable Care Act. And so the dollars and cents issue is really going to force the country to, whether it's because the courts have said the Affordable Care Act is not valid, or just strictly because of the shifts in the environment from the pandemic, we're going to have to address some additional healthcare change in this country.
In reading between the lines, maybe a little bit of what you're saying, it's kind of almost irrespective of what happens, we still need some major steps forward, because the one thing everyone seems to agree on is that the system is still broken and needs major corrective action. But I guess maybe it's just a matter of the full scope of what that means. Is it we're building off of what's already in place because of the ACA, or if the ACA is pulled out, how do we refill the gap left by the ACA and continue to move forward?
Exactly. And if you look at the debate within the Democratic candidates leading up to Mr. Biden being the official nominee, there were improvements on the Affordable Care Act or making sure that there's a public option, or strictly going to a Medicare for all process. Those are at least three of the options that were discussed just within that party. I think what we'll need to do as a country is everyone agrees that there were steps made by the Affordable Care Act. Some believe that it's step backwards, some believe it's step forward, but in order to improve upon what the current status is, we are going to need additional legislative change. Even the issues of if the Affordable Care Act is eliminated, you've seen this for almost a decade now, several of the higher profile issues of, children being able to be covered till they age 26, pre-existing conditions were all bipartisan topics leading up to the Affordable Care Act. And the dialogue over the last 12 or 18 months has really been, how do we protect some of those items, even if the ACA is turned off? Those are the types of things that will have to be foundational, plus the additional issue of 20 million people losing coverage because of the economic challenges of that have been presented by the pandemic.
And have you been hearing any discussion around what some of those solutions could really end up looking like? Because as you just finished with, with all the people who lost primarily employer-based coverage because of the pandemic, the ACA wouldn't necessarily have solved that issue. So, is there any talk about what seems like might end up being some type of fundamental shift?
Yeah, some of what I'm hearing, is of course the public option, being able to really truly have a public option available to the public beyond, the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, or the similar programs that's now available to through TRICARE program, et cetera. Health savings accounts are still get a lot of traction. Then, of course, there's a conversation. Folks out of Kaiser and a few other places that are talking about just don't make it Medicare for all, make it Medicare Advantage for all. So that's a third discussion that's really been getting some traction this late summer and into the fall. Of it's still run, Medicare Advantage programs are still largely run by insurance companies, so it's kind of a hybrid of a bridge to cover more people, but also be able to scale up more quickly to address those that have lost their coverage. That's the third item that I've been hearing quite a bit about.
And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Tom Leary from HIMSS. We're talking about the impact of the election and other events on legislative activity and regulation within healthcare. And Tom, it's interesting that you're just saying that you're hearing that a third option could be, not Medicare for all, but a Medicare Advantage for all. Because that certainly among the health insurance companies, that seems to be the most profitable program out there.
Yeah. They, I've had some conversations with some of our HIMSS members who work for insurance companies or work alongside them, and they're proud of the work that they do through Medicare Advantage. And then, of course, the former Congresswoman Schwartz, Allison Schwartz, out of Pennsylvania, she runs an association that trying to expand Medicare Advantage. And she's a Democrat. It is a moderate, it is more of a moderate position. Or a position that's taken up by some of the moderates within the Democratic Party. So, yeah.
I know we've been talking kind of broadly about healthcare as a whole, but I kind of want to narrow it down a little bit and, sure. Think about, because you've already implicitly referred to it, trying to get some changes made permanent related to the kind of explosive adoption of digital health that occurred through the pandemic. So I feel like I've heard about different bills pending before Congress, which, given where we stand, none of those are going to pass. It would be highly unlikely for any of those to pass before the election. But, what ideas do you think have legs going forward to be able to get reintroduced in the next Congress in January, assuming that nothing passes in the next couple months?
The legislative needs of the legislative requirements that are needed to make some of the temporary waivers permanent around expansion of telehealth, particularly to improve access for underserved communities. The idea of making more of an investment in broadband. Those are two very key areas that we're very supportive of. There is a piece of legislation that was created by the Congressional Telemedicine Caucus or Telehealth Caucus we're actually being very vocal about during over the next several weeks, and with the anticipation that it might be taken up, or at least provisions of it might be taken up as part of the lame duck session, after the election. Alternative sites has proven, and an expansion of the types of providers that can use telemedicine on a permanent basis are two key areas that we think have really borne the positive has been borne out during the pandemic, so making sure that those legislative changes occur so that whether it's FQ federally qualified health centers getting that permanent expansion, or the different types of providers get the ability, maintain the ability to use telehealth. And then the one hot button that I'm not sure how we're going to, I think is going to be discussed, but is the pay equity or the reimbursement equity of a face-to-face versus a televisit. During the pandemic, CMS and then the insurance companies have made the commitment to have reimbursement equity for providers during the pandemic. But I think that's going to be a hotly discussed topic with this, probably into the new year.
Yeah, and actually the pay equity piece is very interesting because, you know, as you said, Medicare has certainly for, you know, the visits that it covers said you're getting paid the same amount as if it was in person during the pandemic. But right. That also seems to go, you know, definitely down to the state level, which I think you referenced earlier of, you know, you always have to think when you're thinking about government relations, both the federal and the state, especially in healthcare, where there are so many areas where there's overlap, but then also clear separations of power.
Absolutely. You know, and what we're advocating for is, you know, across the board, that's really states embrace the benefits of telehealth. But, you know, as we've seen discussed, you know, I'm sure since not too long after the Medicaid program was first initiated, is that states have their programs are unique to their communities, and sometimes that forces certain demographics or certain individuals to be pushed out based on the economics of that particular state. So it's not going to be it's not necessarily a simple legislative solution, because, you know, it's the other thing that we really haven't talked about is the federal government and the state governments, or, you know, the federal government has, you know, with the CARES Act and the appropriation supplementals, and, you know, it's an additional, you know, $3.5 or $4 trillion into the economy. And at some point we're going to have that, that budget balancing reckoning, and the fiscal hawks are starting to get a little bit louder at both the state and the federal level. At what point do you stop writing blank checks and they're really start to address where you draw the line on who gets coverage and who doesn't? And that's really, it feeds itself into what is an improved Affordable Care Act or follow-on to the Affordable Care Act really look like then? So all those pieces, all these variables fit very well together in a discussion. They're not necessarily the easiest thing to solve.
Yeah, no, kind of the circular nature of that discussion that you just raised is, I think, an important point to make, because it's, you know, it feels as though a lot of the kind of proposed remedies that have been identified to help with physicians or care delivery organizations through the pandemic is to continue and move even faster into alternative payments or value-based care. But a lot of those innovation programs, especially everything that's come out of CMS, is all predicated upon having the ACA in place.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, and one of the things that we've seen, you know, with the Obama team and now the Trump team is that it's hard to, it's good to have a Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. It's hard to get some of those pilot programs out and really make them scalable and replicable. So I think that's the other part of the challenge that we'd anticipate in 2021 is how do we as a country really embrace the idea of, we've got some great lessons learned from those innovative activities, and we've seen that ACOs are starting to really embrace and reflect the idea that community-based or coordinated care is possible, and it's possible to improve the quality of care for the individual and reduce or keep the costs in control, in check, but how do you then replicate and scale is still a mystery, particularly the innovation sides.
Yeah, no, it's kind of interesting. And I think it goes to a quote about ACOs that I saw either, you know, very recently, you know, that it's a long journey, and you have to recognize that you're not necessarily going to get the savings in the first couple of years, but you have to allow those changes to really sink in and, you know, change a culture within an organization. And it's at that point that you can really start to see how things are evolving.
Exactly. You know, and how does... the competition within a community, you know, you look at what's happening here in Northern Virginia, just as an example of, you know, you've got the Inova health system, and you've got Sentara that's starting to make its way from further south into the northern market. know, and you've got folks in Maryland and DC that are starting to expand as well. And how do they begin to either work together if they have to, or at what point is competition become coopetition so that the individual gets the kind of care that they need? The other point that I'd make is that organizations that you would think are pretty far advanced in ACO space, when you talk to them, they're pretty upfront about, yeah, we learn every day and we try to improve every day. We don't think we've hit our stride yet. And I think that's true across the country.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully more organizations kind of recognize that state of things, because I feel like no one should ever really be satisfied that they've fully achieved what needs to be achieved. There should always be goals, and as you hit goals, the next ones keep moving further along, because I think it's true in any field that when you start to remain static, then you're going to get left behind.
Exactly. And one of the things that's real important for HIMSS and for our members, particularly here in the United States, is we've been through the challenges and pains and pluses and minuses of the high tech, in the meaningful use program, and then moving to a value-based care. The rest of the world is really curious about, and what we're starting to hear in other parts of the world is that because of the pandemic, they feel that they need to make a meaningful use type investment in their digital health infrastructure. And so they'll be looking to the Americans for, even if you're only 20 minutes ahead of me, you've got 20 minutes more experience in how to do something. I want to learn, because I don't have a blank check, to be able to continue to write for healthcare. I've got to pay for value, not for volume. So the United States should be, and what HIMSS, what we expect to do in the tail end of this year and into 2021 is really be able to hone the messaging on what some of the lessons, the positive lessons learned from the digitization of healthcare here in the United States that can be shared with the rest of the world.
Yeah, no, and that's a very interesting perspective, and one that you might not hear too often. It's because it often feels that what we've done isn't the best, but to some degree, someone has to go first, and then you can learn your own lessons, and then everyone else can learn from you. So kind of, believe it or not, exactly, we're just about out of time.
Right,
so I'll ask you one, I just want to ask one final question, and just to see, are there any under the radar issues that are going to be impacted by the election that you think don't get enough attention?
I don't know that it's necessarily under the radar, but we haven't talked about it yet here. It's privacy, data privacy in general. There are multinational organizations that are interested in taking a GDPR and from Europe and just overlaying it over the United States and other jurisdictions. And then there are folks who have been through GDPR that have said, hey, we've got a lot of lessons learned. Don't just take what we have, and learn from it and tweak it. So I really expect, from a data privacy perspective to include healthcare, that's going to be a big issue in 2021, because it was starting to really ramp up pre-pandemic. It got shifted to the right in terms of timeline, but we haven't answered the question yet. To that end, HIPAA, the proposed rule for HIPAA that's supposed to come out of HHS, I would anticipate that it's before the end of the year. They're really looking at the idea of what have we learned from within the pandemic that wasn't necessarily in the draft beforehand. So it's those types of issues around privacy, data privacy, and interoperability that I think are going to, it won't be front and center on the top of the list for the election, but will have to be addressed in 2021.
And I think that's an important reminder and a great thought to part on, because as I mentioned, believe it or not, we are already out of time. I want to thank my guest, Tom Leary, for a great conversation today.
Well, thank you very much. I look forward to future conversations. Thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, and thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.